Okay. Well, she told you all the other things about me that are up there already. And at the end, you can see AKA the old guy in front of you. So as what I'm going to do is try to go through some slides, and I'm going to present some things to you. I'm actually working on some modeling now, working on a master's in Homeland Defense and Security at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, and looking at the implications and the structuring of the approach of things like NIMS, the National Incident Management System, on community restructuring. How can we use some of the principles we've learned by going into different countries which were in disarray and use those to rebuild communities? But before we get there, we have to start talking about some of the foundational concepts. You know, I created an energy matter spectrum, and what I say is that there is an eastern-western bridge between yang and yin, if you were going to eastern philosophy. And what underlies this is that all these things are being structured into our natural environment and the combination with our critical infrastructure and key resource sectors. There's 17 of them: transportation, education, access to food. So you can go down the list: energy production. How are you actually keeping your community going? What's available? Are you in a food desert? Are you in a place that has no transportation, poor educational system? What are the social consequences of how you organize these energy matter relationships you're living within? So this is about basic foundation for what I'm going to talk about. We also went through our adaptational time period, where we went from a black box of our brain case, right, the bones, and not being able to see anything, to developing senses, which actually reached outside of ourself. And we went through the touch, the taste, smell, hearing, and vision. And what we did was we went from a one-dimensional touch model, point to point, to a three-dimensional vision model, going from matter-based touching to energy-based perception. So we actually went to the spectrum of starting to listen to sound waves, and then we had chemical taste, and then we had direct proximate touch. But we went out into vision so we could see stars, so we increased the sphere of what we could actually be in control of. As we were doing that, we had the physical, emotional, and cognitive development, which went along with that. And many of the times what's going on in our communities is a cognitive dissonance, where the emotional state is out of balance with the cognitive self. The recognition of cognitive worth, your ability to realize your abilities, your skills, your talents, your absolute genius that each one of us possesses. And once those two things are out of balance, we react emotionally to drive how we control our environment rather than cognitively. So this is basically, we also developed the ability to predict the future. We all have that ability. So if you're standing on a street corner and an 18-wheeler is coming and it's two blocks away, you instinctively jump back before it even gets close to you, because your perception has told you that if you were to proceed in this course without abating your course, you would be hit by this truck. So in a sense, you're taking and looking at the probability of what's happening in your environment and making a predictive outcome decision. How are you going to change the course of things? Now, what choices do you have? If you're trapped between two walls and this 18-wheeler is coming down, not much room to go to. So the question is, what kinds of choices do you have in the environment? Can you make a predictive change in your behavior in order to have a good outcome? Now, this is the mouth. If you look at your hand is actually the determinant of your destiny, right? It's the one that allows you to open a door. It's the one that allows you to interact with the environment. It's the one that allows you to manipulate things and move things around. Your hand also brings things to your mouth, and your mouth is the gateway to chronic disease. Most of what we're facing in the healthcare dollar and most of what we're facing in the communities that we're having a lot of suffering in begins at what we're putting through our mouth. If we're in a food desert, we're putting different foods in which are causing things like obesity, cardiovascular disease. Things moved around a little bit on this one. But you have diabetes, kidney disease, hepatitis. All these things have passed through our mouth. Smoking cigarettes, overeating, poisons, illegal drugs, medication misuse, alcohol. those are the leading causes of some of the major medical problems that we are facing, cardiovascular disease, strokes, heart attacks, right? This is something that unless we start looking at all these different components and realizing that this is a common gateway of how we're bringing these things into our body to cause this disease outcome. But what's guiding our behavior? What's making our hand move to do these things instead of eating nutritious things, opening a door for a clinic, opening a door to go and go into a health club, and putting a seatbelt on in a car? Why is our behavior out of sync with what is predicted as a good outcome? Why are we overcome? Why are we blocking this? This is a basic outline looking at how the occupational health arena. I was trained in occupational medicine, and I'm looking at the occupational health arena, how systems are approached in business. So in the industrial environment, we have occupational engineering controls. Either we eliminate, contain, or substitute something for something that is bad that we don't want to bring into the company. So if it's a chemical X, we substitute chemical Y. But chemical Y can also be a problem. If we have containment, if we're using X-ray machines in our hospitals, in our clinics, in the aerospace industry, how do we contain and keep people shielded away from these things that they're being exposed to? Or do we just eliminate it completely and say we're never going to use this? It's so dangerous that we can't bring it into our area. We have administrative controls, personal protective equipment, and then containment systems. But once you breach the system, then you end up having agent exposure. And agent exposures are saying energy matter spectrum, so it can be ultraviolet light that causes skin cancer, cigarette smoke that causes lung cancer, right? Alcohol that causes liver disease, or fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Those things that are in our environment, somehow these agents are breaking through the barriers or the policy decisions we're making, and they're affecting the community, the general population. So on the other side, what do we do in the public health domain? Well, instead of having engineering controls, we have things like House bills and Senate bills. On the legislative side, we have regulatory controls we try to put in place, statutes, rules, behavioral choices, and accidents then come in when we start talking about whether people use their personal protective equipment, whether they eat healthy foods or not. How are they balancing this? And then our healthcare systems, we have local health departments, hospitals, clinics, and private practices. And now we have the ACA, coming in, that's actually starting to address some of these things that we need to talk about. Primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention are also there. Primary prevention is making sure that things never, ever happen. Secondary and tertiary is when you start trying to mitigate the effects of something that's already there. A disease is present, and that you're trying to decrease the poor outcome that's down the line. Now, the CDC has best practice interventions. We have type 1, type 2, and type 3. And you can see how they break down: scientific method, data research analysis, intervention strategies, contextual implementation. I was talking to one of the panelists who's from Louisiana, and I had a group that we went down to Katrina to have impact to try to help during that time period with Rita, Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. And when I went down there, it was almost like a lightning strike that hit me. And what I realized is that there's a how-why bridge. And how is the scientific side. It's how do we make a plane fly? How do we make a car move? The why side is, why should I trust you? The person who's the recipient of the service. And that why part is the part that we have to find out how to bridge. And it's based on their ecumenical beliefs. It's based on their geopolitical situation, how they're looking at life, what experiences they've had in a hospital, have they been turned away before from help. So we have to really look at the total cultural context that an individual we're trying to attempt to help is living within before we can actually even bridge that. How do we really measure what is effective? We say that, it's better to have a house, right? But maybe it's better for them to feel like they have a car. We don't know what the motivation is. When I was down in Louisiana, for example, there was a gentleman who was sitting. He was from Germany, he and his wife, sitting in front of his house crying. He was crying for over 30 hours, he said. He was just from the day before. Didn't get any sleep. And so we were sitting there, and we were talking to him, and he said, I want you to move my boat. And we were like, move your boat, because the boat was on its side. So we got soldiers, right side of the boat, put it on a rack. And all of a sudden, he breathed a sigh of relief. And we were like, wow, that's strange. Why was it so important? Because he had paid his house off. Everything was paid for. And the way that he made his payments on the house and secured everything for his family was with the boat. He was a fisherman. And the right siding of the boat told him that everything was okay. He could go back. He could rebuild. With the boat down, he had no hope. He had lost everything. So it's very, very important to understand what people want and why they need what they want, and to take that step. Okay, here's an exercise for you. What I'm going to have everyone in the room do, this is participatory. I'm going to have you spell some words out loud. Don't worry, I'm not that smart, so the words aren't that long. I want you to spell these words out loud, and then I want you to answer a question immediately. Got it? Okay, first word I want you to spell is crop. Next word is drop. Next word is mop. Next word is crop. Next word is drop. Next word is top. Next word is cop. Next word is drop. Next word is mop. When you get to a green light, what do you do? Aha! So I need some licenses here. What you just experienced was, everyone, it's a natural phenomenon. What you're trying to do is conserve energy. If you were exercising and working out, you have to do cross training, right? Because you get so used and you're so adapt, you know, your ability to adapt is so great that you try to overcome the obstacle you're facing. So you become better and better, and you get less and less out of it. So you have to cross train. So we do that physically. I think we do it mentally as well. But think about this. If that happened to you in seconds, what happens to the person that is constantly told the same thing over and over and over and over again through life? How hard it is for them to break that pattern that's been embedded in their consciousness. So we have to find some way of breaking these cycles in people and making sure that this is going on. When I was practicing and doing residency, I had this thing about the missing line for social disruption. We had this stage 4 diagnosis, you know, stage 4 cancer, stage 3 cardiovascular disease, and we had all these different listings, and there was no line about social order. What's the person going back into? Are you already in a disaster? Are you already in a situation where most people who are in a very stable environment, if they were to be moved into that environment, they would feel they were in a state of disaster? So if I went from my house and I was living on the street, or I was living in a in some form of place where there was a shelter, how would I feel? How would I feel the next day? So it's relative. It depends on how you are organizing your life, what you're getting used to, what you think is okay for you to live with. So the coin toss of order and disorder. If you have a coin and you flip it at 50-50, that's as far as I got in epidemiology and understanding everything. But if you weight one side of the coin, you start to weight it a little bit, right? You start playing with your friends, then you become really rich if you weight it the right way. So if you hate it, if you weight it towards the heads, it comes out that way. We are doing that with our social policies. We are weighting the coin of the coin flip within communities of how these communities will end up. So we put less of an emphasis on education, put less of an emphasis on access to health care. What do you think the outcome is going to be? It's a very simple statistical outcome. We're making it worse and worse. And I talked to you about the hand already, how your hand controls your life. We talked about the how-why bridge and how you go across that. How to address disparities. Now, I'm going to ask you, and not my graduate student who's sitting up here with a camera. She's really incredible. She's the number one graduate student. I can only say that because she's the only one in the room with a grad out of that group. But she's excellent as well. But she actually is doing some projects really, which are phenomenal. One of the questions I ask is, and I was giving a CDC keynote at one point, and the question is, what do you know about Albert Einstein? You're all scientists. You all have some background in healthcare, physics, chemistry, biology, all that. And when I asked them that question, most people said, well, E equals MC squared, you know, greatest scientist ever, a little bit of dyslexia, those kinds of things in his background. Manhattan Project, escape from Nazi Germany. But Albert Einstein was a socially, very, very socially astute person. He was actually the co-chair of the anti-lynching movement with Paul Robeson in his country. He actually gave money to W. Du Bois Boys for his writings, money for the women's suffrage movement to start, NAACP's formation, wrote in the Crisis magazine, and actually taught in Princeton University. But he never taught an undergraduate or graduate student. He was a pure research scientist, bench scientist, never taught a student in that university, other than some of the students he brought with him on occasion. But he taught five blocks from that, and it was an inner-city African-American school. And when he was teaching them, they said, well, you know, what are you doing? You're a genius. Why are you wasting your time with elementary school students? And he said, listen, he said, one of the greatest travesties in the country, and these were poor students, so they were white and Latino students as well in his class. He said, one of the greatest travesties in this country is the wasting of the skills, abilities, talents, and absolute genius within these children. He said, one of the things that I have a difficulty with is that they are facing the same thing I face at the hands of the SS in Nazi Germany, oppression of their ability to thrive and to think. And by and far, one of the greatest diseases in America is racism. Now, this is from Albert Einstein. And when I told this to them, they didn't realize that. But what that does is it cuts this community off from STEAM, science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. Right? And what it does is it causes this person who's on the wall, who has all this crazy hair, and they can't relate to this person. It cuts them off from one of the key figures in science. So the first thing we have to do, as we say in the battlefield, is stop the bleeding. Now, here's another illustrative point. I want you to think, and in your mind, just get a mental image of this, I want you to think of Captain America. Okay, have a picture of him? Did you know he was actually African American? The first comics that came out, it was during the transition of African Americans going into the military. And when the first couple of magazines came out, they said there was so much pushback on having this representation, they changed it. So we had to look at the history and start learning what really did happen. What really did happen with women in the country? What did happen with the elderly? Why was it so important constitutionally to put these protections in for all of us? What really happened, and why did we have to start changing these things, these rules? So I think this is one of those wake-up calls for us to learn a little bit about the community. Relative social disruption model. So we have disorder, we have this general population, resilient population, and special subpopulations with disparity. And what we're trying to do is relative social disruptions, as mentioning before. It depends on what you're used to and what kind of lifestyle you're used to seeing and what your community is like and what you have learned, what the world is really supposed to be. And as you notice in the background, this is at a regular steady state, that there always is a level of disruption. But the problem is this is not an arithmetic scale. So when people will come in and say, well, how many risk factors do you have? I have diabetes, and I have high blood pressure, and is one, we have two risk factors. No, it's really synergistic. You know, we're actually looking at something that is multiplicative, we're geometrically associated, these different risk factors. So it takes you even further out on the curve. It's not that I'm taking care of two problems and I need the resources to take care of two individual problems. I need to take care of depression, smoking, you know, obesity, you know, diabetes, high blood pressure. It's not five things. It can be like 150 things for that one individual to overcome. It becomes much more ingrained, much more of a problem. So the resources that we ask for in public health should be absolutely increased for all the things that we're facing within Appalachians, Chicago. It doesn't make a difference where you are. These things in the rural communities, we need to have the increase in our resources. Here again, this is a thing where we have an incident, a poor outcome event. And don't worry, I have all this stuff on the computer, so you have access to all this stuff later, so you can take a look at it and laugh at it. You know, throw tomatoes at Chicago. I'll be there. and this actually tells you about the general population. How do we get worsening disorder, continued disorder, return to baseline if something were to disrupt things? If we had a storm, if we had a Katrina, and we're seeing more and more of these things, events happening in poor communities throughout the country, how can they come back from where they've been displaced to feel they have a relative order in their life? And this is something that we have resilient populations that will actually build that resilience so they don't go as far up the scale. So we have to figure out what populations are we dealing with. And here we have a thing where the arrows, if you can see the arrows, the three arrows that are in alignment, the actual slope of the line is different because it's easier to displace a population that's already having disparities within its proximity. So this tells you about how far you can go out and how you can come back to a normal order. In the base again, we have the critical infrastructure and key resource sectors and whether people can survive to begin with at all. And in the bottom line, I put down the things like myths, beliefs, philosophies, dogmas, and we can't assume that people are operating on myths. Okay, and we can't assume that people are operating on myths. The one thing that is really critical is that the myths are things that we assume people have. When we were giving H1N1 vaccinations, we had people who turned it down. They said they must be believing in something magic or whatever's going on. No, this person is a construction worker who works 6 days a week, 14 hours a day, will lose their job if they get sick and have to go to the hospital from a reaction from an H1N1 shot, and they're the only one taking care of their family. We have to start thinking about the context, the social context that we're actually working with. These are some of the things that I don't have time to talk about, but ICS features that I think are really important for us to start looking at when we start approaching communities. These principles can actually be very good in organizing ourselves, and then questions. And my time is up, so I know it's really fast and brief, but if anyone has any questions, they can ask.